some things in life are bad. They can really make you mad. Other things just make you swear and curse. When you're chewing on life's gristle, that grumble, give a whistle. And this'll help things turn out for the best. And always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the light side of life. If life seems jolly rotten, there's something you've forgotten, and that's to laugh and smile and dance and sing. When you're feeling in the dumps, don't be silly chumps, just purse your lips and whistle, that's the thing. Hey,
always look on the bright side of life.
It's quite absurd, and death's the final word. You must always face the curtain with a bow. Forget about your scene, give the audience a grin. Enjoy it, it's your last chance anyhow.
So always look on the bright side of death. Just before you draw your terminal breath.
Life's a piece of shit when you look at it. Life's a laugh and death's a joke, it's true. You'll see it's all a show. Keep them laughing as you go. Just remember that the last laugh is on you. And
always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the right side of life.
Records available in the foyer.
Always
look on the right. Got a live as well, you know. Alright, it's a lot. Let's get this place up there.
Always look on the right.
Change his mantle within 3 weeks. What do you think plays for this rubbish?
Always look on
the money back, you know. I told him. I said to him. Bernie, I said, they'll never make that money back.
And here we go, boys and girls. It's a Moon's Day. And keep your eye on the prize, as the Negroes say. It is 2014, and it's, what is it? It's the 24th day. How about that? So we're all set to go. Don't forget us at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. And that's where you send your donations. Yep. Yeah. And your snail mail. And also go up to resist.com, that big giant website of ours. And you can get a master's degree in race separation, economics, environment, all kinds of stuff. I'm telling you, you wouldn't even need to go to school. Wouldn't need to go to college if you just absorb everything that's on that website. I hope you liked my Monty Python tribute there. Always look on the bright side. That's what I tell all you haters out there. Always look at the bright side. That's all you see on the internet is racism. Oh my God, race, the racists are coming. Run for your lives. Run for your lives. You should be so happy. Yeah. Everything's going just right. The Republicans, Republicrats, and the Democrazies are going at each other for each other's throat like mad on the radio and the television. That's great. Tear them apart. Tear each other apart. That works for us. Plus, you're still one of those lost in the woods white racial separatists that are still clinging to that property party, the ones that are against collective bargaining and who side with the corporations all the time and then claim, oh, we love white working people. Well, no, they barely say they like working people. Yeah. Well, let's start out today with some items I picked up off the airwaves last night. And you might be extremely surprised. You may be shocked. You may be offended. And you may be pissed. But these are statements from a quote-unquote black historian. Now, the reason I want to put these on here is because many times if you read between the lines of a black researcher, you can get information that's very important to your argument. Now, my argument is that all these presidents are war criminals. Now, what I'm going to play to you is what was going on in the First World War. Number one, if Wilson, Woodrow, had really had respect for the white people of America, especially the working class, he would not have got involved in World War One at all. It's too bad it even took place in Europe, but to get involved and send thousands of our men, mostly white men, over there was bad enough. But then he started getting the blacks to go over there. Yeah, and brag about killing white Germans, just like World War II. Twice. Once the white working class was stabbed in the back by Wilson, and the next time they were stabbed in the back by FDR. Let's see if I can find you a piece here, and you just listen to this, and I'm telling you, makes you sick, but not sick enough to die. Sick enough to make maybe sometime other people die.
Our theme for these remaining days of African American History Month, not many left, would be World War One. And you, and speaking of foremost scholars, I mean, CR has been the foremost scholar when it comes to the African American role in the military and in military history. So please, CR, tell us all about World War One.
Well, last week we talked about the role of Africa and Africans, and just to go back just for a second, for those who might not have heard, it's important to consider the fact that perhaps a million African soldiers, another, by some amounts, some estimates, a million African non-combatants served in one fashion or another in the First World War. That from the beginning, African troops, as early as 1914, were called into France. And while when we look at the record that they fought in the trenches of Western Europe on the Gallipoli Peninsula, and yes, in East Africa. In fact, the last troops, African troops, because of the colonial period, found themselves fighting on both sides. And the last German troops to surrender in World War One were actually fighting under the German Imperial Eagle in East Africa. And this primarily African force, led by a German commander named Paul Lietau von Vorbeck, surrendered after the armistice at Versailles. So when we understand that, and we understand that one of the causes of the war was the intense colonial competition for land in Africa. In 1898, Britain and France had looked over their gun sights at each other at a remote place in the Nile Valley called Fashoda, again in Morocco, just a few years later. And so we understand, as Andre Six says in his History of Black Africa, Volume 2, that one of the causes of the First World War was a territorial competition that went on in Africa. So we know that Africans were involved from the beginning of the war. 1917, we come in, African Americans are mobilized as part of it. But we need to acknowledge that the first black American unit called up was in the nation's capital. The segregated Jim Crow units, the first separate battalion, which you'll appreciate, Brother Mark, drilled at the True Reformers Hall at 1200 U Street Northwest.
Is that right?
Yeah, they drilled it. They had an armory before that up near the Old Street Market, for those of you that are familiar at all with the nation's capital.
Wow.
They drilled, would later drill, at the True Reformers Hall. They were called up to protect the public facilities of Washington, D.C., the water, for example, the reservoir, those kinds of things, public buildings. And these men were very proud of this, even though the American military command, just before the war and during it, didn't want black officers, yet progressive whites and black people were able to lobby. And it was a Jim Crow camp, but it was set up at Camp Des Moines, and hundreds of black officers were trained. And then, of course, we come to the battlefield.
Mm-hmm.
And most everybody has heard of Sergeant York.
Mm-hmm.
But whether they've heard of Henry Johnson and Needham Roberts is another matter entirely. And so this is, imagine, if you will, two black men in a foxhole in advance of the front lines. And they're hit about, perhaps by some estimates, 40, 50 Germans. And this is a fight at night in the dark. And it gets down to bare knuckles, bayonets, and grenades. And as they carry Needham Roberts off, Brother Henry throws some grenades, rescues his brother, brings him back. And when they go out to assess the action the next day, they find the bodies of several Germans strewed all over the landscape. And so this man, this is one of the things that is absolutely important. And the reason I wanted to get a jump on it, people say, well, why don't you wait until 2017, since we're celebrating, we're talking about World War One, because this year marks the beginning of the centennial commemoration, First World War. We want to get a jump on it. We want people to start doing their own research. Most importantly, we had a brother who spoke at one of the last week. His father served in World War One. So we want you to get out your family papers, see if your parents fought in the First World War, and go out and tell those stories. Because you might know, as I say, about Sergeant York, but about the bravery of the men of the Harlem Hellfighters, the New York 369, you might not be aware. And these are stories. We also need to say that there were black men in the Navy during the First World War, and a small contingent of African-American nurses called up at the end of the war to help in part with the great Spanish influenza outbreak. And there were black women. Sisters rolled out as an extension of the Black Women's Club movement, that great upwelling of energy and commitment that black women showed from roughly the end of the Civil War, certainly to the beginning of the 20th century, and a whirlwind of organization and effort and community uplift. And so they spoke for bonds, they purchased bonds, they spoke out against lynching and Jim Crow. And we also, undergirding all of this, was a desire for black people to demonstrate their fitness for citizenship at a period. The First World War occurs during one of the most violent anti-African-American periods in history. We're talking about lynchings of black men and black women on an almost daily basis. I was showing people last night in Baltimore the story of a young woman who was lynched alongside her son. We know about black men, but we understand that people like Mary Turner's lynched around the time of the First World War.
What was her name again?
So this
was was her name?
Mary Turner.
Mm-hmm.
Mary Turner, the lynching of Mary Turner. In fact, it inspired a sculpture by a woman who's largely forgotten now, Meta Fuller. It was actually Meta Valk Warwick Fuller who did a statue because people could not believe that a pregnant black woman would be lynched in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
But this was a constant refrain. So in a mission, and Du Bois, W.B. Du Bois, of course, writes the great poems. He also leaks a secret memoranda that from the high command that says we don't want excess familiarity between the French people and black American troops because it upsets white Americans.
Wow.
So don't shake hands with them. Don't praise them too highly. You know, these kinds of things. And so he leaked that and he put it in the Crisis magazine. And so when we talk about, in general terms, about World War One and the American role in it, the Americans declare war, participate from April 1917 until the armistice in November 1918. This is why we celebrate Veterans Day, young folk. There's a reason for this. And your family could very well have direct involvement in that conflict. We know about the famous black units from World War II.
Mm-hmm.
We've done movies about those units, but we have done very little on black soldiers in World War One and the unique challenges they faced. And remember, these men, about 380,000 or so, would return to what James Weldon Johnson called the Long Red Summer. Two dozen race riots, including Washington, D.C. And so, unlike when black soldiers returned from World War II, I mean, they ran into many difficulties. They ran into political obdurance that wanted to remind them to stay in their place. But it was much more naked after the First World War. And so two dozen race riots from Longview, Texas to Washington, D.C. It's an extraordinary time, and it deserves to be much better known. And I hope next week we'll talk more about the civilian aspect of World War One and African Americans.
Du Bois' words in the Close Ranks editorial, we return from fighting, we return fighting. Indeed, what an historic time. Historian C.R. Gibbs joins us every Friday during African American History Month. Thank you, C.R., for that history, my brother, okay?
Well, there you go. There you go. And incidentally, it was an anniversary of Malcolm X's assassination, too. And I don't know whether anybody ever did time for that or not, but I know they were suspecting that Farrakhan's boys did that job, but I don't know. And but it's interesting. Old Malcolm X was a pretty honest black man. Of course, he wasn't totally black. He had red hair. He was partly white. But his father had been assassinated, pushed in front of a train. I forget what city it was in. Maybe Chicago. And so he had an axe to grind, and he was much more one to be respected, as far as I'm concerned, than Martin Luther King. It was Malcolm X that put the fear into the big money boys. You see, when they got the riots going all over the country, and all these major cities, and then they were burning out the juice stores in Washington, D.C., the capitalist ruling class, white boys and Jews, say, oh, man, we can't have that, you know. So from then on, he was a marked man. And on this stuff about World War One, you see, this is why I say these presidents are warmongers, psychopaths, and they care nothing about thousands and thousands of white men dying for slogans and for the waving that flag, you know, and things like that. So there you see that the French brought all these African Negroes into France, you know, to help fight the war. And of course, that's what really started this big problem with miscegenation between Negroes and whites in France. And even though every country's had that problem, France pretty well opened up the door for it. And then, as you can see, that these wars are capitalist or mercantile originated. All of that started with the feuding over pieces of territory in Black Africa, where the European powers wanted the goodies that the Black Africans had. Now, you may think that's okay to just go into a country and because they're poor and uneducated and ignorant and all that kind of stuff and just take what they've got. I'm not that kind of guy myself. I believe that people should be racial and they should be nationalist too. And so all of this problem that's been brought down on the white working class has come from this kind of stuff, this fighting over the goodies in Africa and so forth. And then Wilson, who was pretty much callous and out of his mind to involve us in World War One, and that's when once the military accepted the blacks, well, they did in the Civil War. I forget how many 100,000 fought on the side of the North, and at the end, they even were recruiting a lot of blacks to fight for the South and giving the promise of freedom. Now, I was thinking about this one day. Here I go, thinking. I said, you know, what would have happened? Now, we can all say this, what coulda, coulda, shoulda, woulda. But what if there had been strong white militias in the South prior to the Civil War, and they had gotten the message that this is a screwed up deal here, you know, all these blacks living in a welfare state on the plantations, and we're sucking hind tit out here, even competing with them for work, while the master sits up there in his big house on the front porch with those mint juleps and those beautiful ladies, while we're barely making it, trying to eke out a living, raising little tobacco and stuff like that. Now, what if all those guys would have got together, or some strong men, you know, like that were some of the outlaws of that day, Jesse James and those kind of guys? Of course, they came after the war, but still, that kind of character, and got together and secretly went the rounds to the plantations and got the message into the blacks that, look, here's the deal. We can set you free. And if we get a big enough force here and we start freeing you blacks from the plantations and cutting the throats of the plantation owners, then you must, of course, agree that you're going to go back to Africa. And we're going to make sure you get there, because I know you don't have any ships or anything like that. We'll commandeer those ships from the Jew boys, and we'll get you over to the coast. We'll get hundreds of thousands of you over to the coast, and then we'll start repatriating you to Africa in a sane and humane way. And maybe give you a little something or money or what when you get on the shore over there in Africa. And then if there are any hard cases that refuse to go, well, they would be forcibly removed from North America by what other mean possible. And if they resisted too much, they would be just shot. That's all there was to it. So that was what I was thinking, and look how many white men that would have saved. Except there's one thought came to my mind. If the capitalists were threatened with losing their free slave workforce, what would their reaction have been? And I would bet you anything that the big capitalists in the North and the planters would combine, and Lincoln would have sent troops into the South to stop the white working class militias from rounding up the blacks, freeing them, and getting them on the ships back to Africa. I'll bet you anything. I'll bet you they would have been prepared to kill even more than died in the Civil War to keep the slavery. See, you say, well, they were freed anyhow a little later. Well, no, they weren't freed. They went from chattel slavery to wage slavery. And they did a job to bring the labor prices down for the white people in the North, strike breakers and scabs. So it would have been an interesting situation if it had came to that. Or maybe they wouldn't, maybe the capitalists would have backed off with the threat of a white working class rising in not only the South but the North to support that kind of a program. Because remember, there weren't that many people in the North that were had love, you know, major love for the blacks. They didn't want to kill them, and they didn't even want to enslave them, most of them did, but they wanted them out of there, you know. They didn't want to be around blacks. They wanted to be, as we are, white separatists. So, anyhow, I'll try to pick up more of this kind of stuff for you, and stuff that you're not going to get with most of the right wing that I've ever heard of, about the exploits of Marcus Garvey and black nationalists and things like that. There's even still a possibility of some interesting situations. Let me put it that way. Now, however, I have worked for years in attempting to negotiate with black nationalists. But unfortunately, it hasn't gone very far. Louis Farrakhan, he's living like a king up there in Chicago with houses all over the country. He puts out this 45-page paper every couple of weeks, full color, everything, and he's using half the paper to keep them interested in spooks in the sky, which, of course, that's the biggest slave master that the blacks have adopted even while they were slaves, and that was the Jew religion of Christianity, the alien religion. They were better off as animists, as they were originally in Africa. So anyhow, so by now we've got to have it in our head that there's no future at all with this Republicrat stuff and this neocons and these conservatives. There's no future for the white race, the white working class working with these people. They're the enemy. And they tell you right on the radio and TV now, they're becoming more and more into race mixing all the time. It was all a phony deal to get the votes from the South that Nixon set up to take it away from the Democrats and get it into the Republican sphere of influence, and that was what it was all about. It wasn't about throwing off this whole so-called civil wrongs idea that we're never going to mix that well, and there's always going to be violence and crime against each other, and there needs to be separation. So anyhow, that's it about that for today. Well, let's hear a little bit from our rogue guy, the progressive, about this slant drilling up there in the Arctic Circle by Shell Oil and how they're screwing things up.
May be coming to a screaming halt, the plans to drill, slant drill for oil. L.A. Times reported a few days ago that the Coast Guard has found evidence of all sorts of safety violations, and these violations have been referred to the Justice Department. I know, I know. And there was some kind of breaking news later this evening, that, or earlier this evening, that said Shell is thinking about just giving up the whole thing for 2013. But according to the LA Times, the Coast Guard found evidence of multiple safety and environmental violations in the Shell Alaska's Noble Discoverer Arctic drilling rig. And the Coast Guard forwarded all this information to the Justice Department for decision about possible civil or criminal penalties. That was confirmed by authorities last Friday. And as the time, LA Times says, the news is the latest setback for Shell's troubled Arctic drilling program, launched last summer off the coast of Alaska to tap one of the world's biggest remaining oil and gas deposits. And already, the company's second Arctic drilling rig, the Kuluk, is facing substantial repairs after coming loose. Remember those pictures from a tow through the Gulf of Alaska and grinding up on the rocks near Kodiak Island? Now it appears that the Noble Discoverer has problems of its own. Detailed in a Coast Guard report that was made available this week to the House Natural Resources Committee. Get this. The Coast Guard found a lack of preventive maintenance and systematic failure led the Discoverer to experience a loss of its propulsion system, an explosion in its exhaust system. That's according to a letter sent to Shell's president from U.S. Representative Ed Markey. There were 14 other detailed reported deficiencies. The letter also cited Shell's own discovery of possible unauthorized collected water discharges outside the allowable period for drilling operations, whatever the hell that means. Markey wrote, quote, "The reports that Shell may have been drilling this summer using a drill ship with serious deficiencies in its safety and pollution control equipment raise additional and continued questions about whether Shell is able to drill safely offshore in the Arctic." I can answer that, Representative Markey. "And raises serious questions regarding the nature and adequacy of Shell's compliance with applicable laws and regulations." End quote. Representative Ed Markey writing to the president of Shell. Now, again, the violations appear to be serious enough that the Coast Guard officials in Alaska said they have referred the case to the Justice Department for, you know, review. The Coast Guard reportedly also found that the Discoverer, that's the Noble Discoverer, that drilling rig, is not able to maintain sufficient speed at sea to maneuver safely in all conditions without a tow. The Coast Guard discovered multiple dead-end wires and improper wire splices in the engine room. The Coast Guard discovered that the main engine cooling water was contaminated with oil and sludge. The vessel experienced an abnormal propeller shaft vibration on the way back from the Arctic in November, requiring the crew to shut down the vessel's main engines and have the rig towed to the port of Seward. Representative Markey wrote, quote, "It is imperative that any drilling operations in the Arctic Ocean occur with the highest levels of safety and environmental protections in place. And I'm not convinced that these levels can ever be met given the extreme weather condition and Shell's performance thus far." I'm not mocking Markey. I'm just saying, what does it take? What does it take for these companies to be just flat out denied permission? What's going to happen when the Keystone XL pipeline, if it is approved, if it is given permission, and it crosses the Ogallala aquifer that provides water for what? I don't know, 30, 40, 60, 22, 18, 90, 70, 40%? Of America's food crops, or something like that. A Shell spokesman said, of course, we take any deficiency very seriously, including those associated with the main propulsion system that surfaced after the Noble Discoverer had transited out of the Chukchi Sea. At no time was the Noble Discoverer found or believed to be a danger to people or the environment while drilling in the Chukchi Sea in 2012. Had that been the case, why, we would have ceased all operations immediately. Do you believe him? Do you?
Well, has Craig Cobb brought bad karma to North Dakota? Seems like things, if you'll read their newspapers, things are getting a little hairy in North Dakota. Yeah. Listen to this.
I wonder if that one's made in China. What do you think? Damned old blowout preventers. They just never prevent blowouts, do they? Anyway, began leaking up to 3,000 gallons per day of fracking fluid. That's the chemicals, water, and sand. Sounds, I don't know, just sounds kind of not very threatening. Chemicals, water, and sand, that's about it. And 200 barrels per day of oil. Yeah, as of last Friday, fluids from the leak were being collected and trucked from the site. And the oil company, Whiting Petroleum, insists, of course, that none of the liquids entered the water. Although, okay, some oily mist did spray onto the frozen creek. Okay, little mist. What the hell's a little mist? The head of the state's Department of Mineral Resources said in a conference call, quote, this leak is a large one and also a health and human risk. It's a big one. Pressure and control of the well is essentially priority number one for oil and gas companies, end quote. Oh, please, Lynn Helms, head of North Dakota's Department of Mineral Resources. Pressure and control is essentially not even in the top 10 priorities for oil and gas companies. Come on, the first nine priorities are profit, 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 profit. And number 10 is low labor cost, which, of course, is not happening in North Dakota. They're making a fortune up there, aren't they? But it is not number one priority, pressure and control of the well. No, 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 no. Come on. Come on, for Christ's sake. Yesterday, it was unclear if the well had been fixed. Calls to both Whiting Petroleum and North Dakota Mineral Resource Department were not returned. Though the harmful effects of an oil leak are widely known, less is known about the effects of the chemicals used in the hydraulic fracturing process. Fracking is a method of extracting fossil fuels coveted for its ability to increase the flow of oil or gas from a well. This is done by injecting high-pressure water and chemicals miles deep into the ground into subsurface rock, effectively fracturing the rock. In North Dakota, regulations in that state only require companies to disclose chemicals that are classified as hazardous substances by OSHA. But, as noted by the National Resources Defense Council, OSHA does not classify all dangerous chemicals as dangerous. So, February, what do we have here? 13th, the train carrying crude oil from Canada derailed in Pennsylvania, spilling 3,000 to 4,000 gallons of oil. Same day, natural gas pipeline exploded in Kentucky, setting fires, destroying homes. 2 days earlier, on the 11th, 100,000 gallons of coal slurry spilled in the waterway near Charleston, West Virginia. On that same day, Chevron natural gas well exploded in Greene County, Pennsylvania. List goes on. February 2nd, a stormwater pipe burst under an unlined coal ash pond, a retired coal plant in Eden, North Carolina, draining 82,000 tons of coal ash mixed with 27 million gallons of water into the Dan River. On the 5th, 12,000 gallons of crude oil leaked from the Canadian Pacific Railway train on Monday in Minnesota, dribbling oil along the tracks for 68 miles. On the first, a train carrying fuel, oil, fertilizer, methanol derailed in southeast Mississippi, forcing a local evacuation. Oh, wait, I have an update. Allison Ritter of the North Dakota Department of Mineral Resources said today that the well was contained and under control back on Friday. Allison said the department will also be conducting a, quote, very serious postmortem.
Lynn, listen in on a little comment about Henry Ford's action back in the old days. Good argument against the people who argue against raising a minimum wage, because Henry Ford at least doubled the wages of his workers at one time and subsequently created a boom to where his employees were buying his cars.
Minimum wage were used against Henry Ford.
Yes.
He wanted to implement the minimum wage for factory workers, but
yes.
That, I thought, had an amazing boom on our economy. Why aren't we using that as an example of what that actually does to economies?
Excellent point, and where I thought you were going to go with that. Henry Ford raised the wage in his factories, in part due to union pressure, in part due to pressure from his wife, and in part due to pressure from his business partner, who went on to become a very progressive Michigan State Senator, and maybe a U.S. Senator, I don't recall. And Henry Ford personally was opposed to it, but he ended up taking credit for it for the rest of his life. He raised the wage from, as I recall, $1 a day, or maybe it was $1 a week, to $5 a day, or $5 a week, whatever it was. And Horace Dodge, who owned a competing car company, sued him before the Michigan Supreme Court and said, Henry Ford is paying his workers too much, and now my workers are starting to get restless, and they're giving me a hard time, and his job as a businessman should be to make money, not to be a charity, not to be paying his workers well. And it went before the Michigan Supreme Court, and the Michigan Supreme Court ruled two things. They ruled, one, that yes, in fact, Dodge's argument was correct, that Henry Ford's job was to make money, that a corporation's first mission is to provide for its stockholders. But two,
if you want to get a few laughs, you go up to Hulu, the movie channel on the cable, if you've got it. And there's a section on there called the Criterion series. And what it is a giant reservoir of old films, some real old and some not so old, and foreign films. And last evening I was nosing around, always looking for a little morsel, and I found one called Shock Corridor. Now the plot of the film is that this reporter wants to get the Pulitzer Prize. So he devises a way with his girlfriend and his boss of the newspaper to get him certified as being nuts and get him into the mental health facility, so to speak, so he can expose the murder of a patient that took place inside the hospital. But that's part of the story. Is really not much there, but the people that are inside the place, you know, like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. There's one guy in here whistling Dixie all the time. He thinks he's Nathan Bedford Forrest, wears the hat and everything. But I'm going to play you a clip of this black guy who's in there who thinks he's white and the head of the Klan. Yeah. And at one point, he actually harangues the crowd of patients to rush headlong down the halls of this mental health facility to grab a mulatto worker there in the hospital. They're going to kill him. And it's being urged on by this black guy that thinks he's in the Ku Klux Klan.
Sounds good. No. Ku Klux Klan. Sounds more mysterious, more menacing, more alliterative. Ku Klux Klan. Say it.
Ku Klux Klan.
KKK.
KKK.
It'll catch on quick. It'll drive those carpetbaggers back north. Scare the hell out of them. Tar and feather them. Hang them. Burn them. Who are you?
Your friend.
I don't know you.
I got air busters. With the mostest men, General Forrest, Nathan Bedford Forrest.
General, you going around taking credit for founding the KKK. I'm the founder. I'm the Grand Wizard. What's our code word?
Secrecy.
General, if Christ walked the streets of my hometown, he'd be horrified. You've never seen so many black people covering up our schools and buses and cafes and washrooms. I'm for pure Americanism. White supremacy! Listen to me, Americans. America for Americans. We got to throw rocks and hurl bombs. Black bombs for black foreigners. So they like hot music, do they? But we'll give them a crescendo they'll never forget. Burn that freedom bus. Burn those freedom riders. Burn any man who serves them at a lunch counter. Burn every dirty nigger loving pocketbook integrationist. Collect a lot of blackjacks and good long lengths of pipe. Show those rabble rousers they can't breathe our white air and go to school with our white children. But get some inflammable liquid and pour it on them. We'll pour it on their homes and burn them. Pour it on their pickaninnies and set them on fire. Call out the members of the White Citizens Council. Call out the KKK. Yes, we'll sponsor the Africans North. Get rid of every black mother, son, and daughter. America for Americans!
America for Americans!
Keep our schools white!
Keep them white! That's right! Keep them white!
I'm against Catholics!
Hallelujah, man! Hallelujah!
Against Jews!
Hallelujah! Hallelujah! Hallelujah!
Against niggers!
Hallelujah! Hallelujah!
Against niggers!
Hallelujah!
Against niggers!
Hallelujah!
That's one! Let's get that black boy before he marries my daughter!
Hallelujah! Hallelujah! So he harangues the patients into a mob, and they go chasing this poor old mulatto. He's about 60 or 70 years old. Down the hall, and they're going to kill him and hang him. It's a wild-ass movie, I'll tell you that. Remember, this guy was black as the ace of spades, and he was even had a pillowcase with KKK written on, and eye holes punched in, and he was wearing over his head. Here's just a little bit more of that bit.
Mistake, so I heard.
No, you didn't. I just told you.
That's right. You know why you're shouting up to me? You want to carry my sign.
No, I don't.
Calling me a liar?
No.
You make your own sign and carry it. You coming to the meeting?
What meeting?
Africa? Do you know the conductor of the State Symphony Orchestra?
No.
I do. He comes here now and then as guest conductor of our own hospital band. I like him, but... He's mixed up.
How do you mean?
He permits a black boy to play with white musicians. Imagine a black boy. Well, they're all right as entertainers, but... Let's kill him before he marries my daughter!
Well, anyhow, that's the end of that clip from this black guy that thinks he's in the Ku Klux Klan. In fact, he thinks he started the KKK, and he accuses the guy who he identifies as General Nathan Bedford Forrest of not really starting KKK. This guy, this black guy, started it. Anyhow, yeah.
That's right.
Idea of a black man serving folks in the White House makes my left eye start twitching. It seems that the only way black people can get nominated for Oscars is if we play servants. Adam McDaniel won for playing a slave in Gone with the Wind. Morgan Freeman got an Academy Award nomination for driving Miss Daisy. I wish he drove her like Ted Kennedy. Octavia Spencer won Best Supporting Actress for The Help. She pooped in a pie. A pie, Miss. We got a black president, and all we can play is servants. Now, they did let Morgan Freeman play the president in that movie Olympus Is Falling, and they let Jamie Foxx play the president in White House Down. That's right. The two times they let a black man play the president in the movies, the effing White House got blown up. Is it me, or is it some kind of subliminal message? What's next? Uncle Ben and a summer blockbuster? They stole his rice. They shouldn't have done that. Uncle Ben is back with his 44 Magnum starring in Dirty Rice. This time it's personal. On second thought, I'm going to see the butler. What is you going to do?
Thank you very much, Lightning. So I have a
Well, I see by Farrakhan paper here that whites are not the only kids that are being molested in the Catholic Church. Files released... let me see here. Let me get my glasses on. Files released by the Chicago Catholic Archdiocese showed decades of systematic secrecy and protection of pedophile priests. However, for some victims of abuse, the nightmare continues and justice remains elusive. David Nolan is 46 years old. His harrowing tales of abuse began at 13. Years of age, his father Victor Stewart, now deceased, used his authority and power to have sex with dozens of young boys at will, and seemingly without any fear of being punished. The Nolan tragedy provides almost a case study in how pedophile priests victimize the black community also. In files of released as part of the settlement in a sexual abuse case, the Chicago Catholic Archdiocese was clearly aware of many allegations of sexual abuse involving Father Stewart. Documents show victims reported Dr. Stewart and other priests were part of a club that participated in pedophilia. Mr. Nolan said the church shuffled priests from parish to parish to protect its image, not children and families in the church. Church leaders knew all along abuse charges were true, he said. Quote, I've continued to be abused over the years, not only by the Chicago Archdiocese, but by our legal system. It destroyed my marriage because I didn't have no recourse. I didn't know how to deal with it. It destroyed my relationships with family. So now to hear that these documents are being released, I'm saddened. I'm dismayed. I'm disappointed because the church I grew up loving, when they had a chance to really display the spirit and truth of Christ, they chose to persecute me and label me as a liar. Father Stewart was considered a godfather to many young boys with no role models or mentors. As a religious figure in a crime-ridden Englewood neighborhood, he was placed on a pedestal. Many of the young men were impoverished backgrounds, enjoyed receiving gifts Father Stewart showered them with. New clothes, gym shoes, video games. These gifts came with a price, inappropriate touching, sex, and a vow of secrecy. Well, there you go. Pedophiles strike all the races, I assume. And because the church has the power to sweep it under the rug and keep it quiet. These cardinals and so forth, these leaders in the Catholic Church or any church that's involved in this kind of stuff should be not only fired but jailed. Well, they're having quite a bit of problems down there in Venezuela, I see. But it's not going to go very far the way it is because it's mostly middle-class people are demonstrating, not the poor. And if they expect this to go anywhere, they're going to have to recruit the poor along with the middle class. Otherwise, their demonstration will not go anywhere. Well, I'm going to send out an addendum from the end of the show. I messed up a little bit there on my editing. So we're going to read from James Mason's siege again. And this particular section is called Later On We'll Conspire. A comrade sent me a pamphlet issued by a bunch of idiots who happened to be the proud owners of some professional printing equipment and who thereby imagined themselves qualified to speak on the subject of revolution. In this pamphlet, they darkly talk in grave tones about conspiratorial activity. At that point, my suspicions of them, which I had had since the mid-70s, were confirmed. They are children playing with matches. The term conspiracy is not now and never has been part of my vocabulary. It is dangerous, I should say unnecessarily dangerous, for conspiracy means talk, and talk is counter-revolutionary. Talk is what the system and its pimps love most of all. In case you didn't know it already, you can do big federal time for merely conspiring to do something. You need not take any action, only talk about it to a circle of three or more, including yourself. And that constitutes conspiracy. And one of the favorites of the system is to charge people with conspiring to violate civil rights, which sometimes doesn't even require the discussion of any action. But of course, you figure that you are too careful for that, huh? You think you know that you can trust people you deal with, right? Let me quickly relate the story of how two brothers were framed by the feds and who are now serving six-year terms for conspiracy. A hired pimp was sent into their group in Columbus, Ohio in 1977 to first gather information and later to act as an agent provocateur. He spent 2 years building his credibility before he began to get a little bold with his suggestions. It doesn't matter how tight your imagined security is if it includes one professional pimp. This agent kept bucking for some kind of action, something solid, as a strike against forced busing in Columbus. Finally, he got around to the idea of bombing a school. Then came the brothers' big mistake. They did not at that moment say to the pimp, "Get thee behind me." They listened and they discussed the pros and cons. And later in the federal courtroom, after their arrest by an army of FBI agents, they saw and heard themselves on widescreen motion picture conspiring with police agents to bomb a school building. An all-white jury didn't take even 30 minutes to return a verdict of guilty. Rockwell, in 1965, conjured up that exact scene of one day having to sit in a court of law and watch yourself on film. Well, gang, 1984 arrived a long time ago. This Big Brother system is held in power largely through pimps, both professional and amateur. Actually, it is a pimp system, a whole society of loose-lipped blabbermouths. Law enforcement would nearly shut down without its pimps, who are in most cases not even agents. In the true sense, they're just babbling idiots. The professional hired pimps are one thing. Loose talk and stupidity are another. But they both lead to the same disastrous result, and they both are defeated the same way. Don't conspire, don't talk. In effect, it's only illegal to get caught, only illegal to trip up. You don't need to ever enter into a conspiracy. You don't need to ever deal with persons who might later let loose with a fatal talk. We must have acts of revolution. The sooner the better, the more the merrier. But these are all of a nature that they can and must be carried out by individuals, and that removes all requirements for talk, the possibility of conspiracy, and the danger of a leak. Now listen to this here. This is way back. It must have stuck in my mind, and I don't even remember it. Back in September of 1980, his next sentence is, "The lone wolf cannot be detected, cannot be prevented, and seldom can be traced." Now, I imagine that in reading this way back there, it must have stuck in my mind, because there he is promoting the lone wolf. For his choice of targets, he needs little more than the daily newspaper for suggestions and tips galore. But it is necessary that the National Socialist Liberation Front begin again its program of systematic infiltration of the Reds, the unions, the local Democrat and Republican cells, and so forth, even the local NAACP. You need not be colored to join. We do have need of privileged information that will have greater need in the future. For his training, the lone wolf needs only the U.S. military or any other one of 100 good manuals readily available through radical bookstores. Equipment is still easily available, and I caution against possessing illegal weapons, as they aren't necessary. And even though the system may be expected to enact more anti-gun laws, this will only serve to stimulate the ever-growing black market for armaments, thus producing an ever greater pool of human resources for us to recruit from. His greatest concern must be to pick his target well, so that any act may speak so clearly for itself that no member of the white America can mistake the message. If you can't do it, leave it alone. Forget it. Don't try and talk someone else into doing it. And especially don't hear of anyone else trying to talk you into anything. Don't talk, period. However, it can't hurt to begin now to learn, to train, and to have materials ready. And that was September 1980. Okay, let's see here. Well, let's go on here for a little while. Helter Skelter is coming down. But while membership and support for traditional movement has just about died, look what has been born in just the past year or so. To call it the movement or to call it the right would be a bad misnomer. From the forces favoring life itself, there has begun an assault, not just in the United States, but in Europe as well. Not more parliamentary garbage, which plays by master's rules, but armed assault. A few of the more aspiring attempts were frustrated, but as we have said, only because they were first infant steps. Others will follow and will secede. Those which have been the most uniformly successful have been the one-on-one gut animal level encounters. Encounters one might well only a few years ago have ascribed as a peculiar to the jungle. The system's Justice Department announced that it has 14 major U.S. metropolitan areas under surveillance by what is referred to as Community Relations Service. It means that one, at least, of the milestones we set for the scenario immediately preceding a revolution has arrived, when the system can no longer pay billions in tribute to the millions of savages in its cities, then we might look for some action. The means of which the system hopes to prevent this from happening lies in their trying to redirect violence, or in other words, defuse the bomb. The main weapon they will have to do this with is the infiltration of both sides of radical spheres, black and white, and useful infiltrators to screw things up. Is this not what we have been reading about so often lately? But problem upon problem will compound that the Big Brother system, and the time will soon come when, first, he has trouble paying enough pimps to keep the revolutionary movement from climbing to its feet, and second, the time is going to come when few individuals will want to take that kind of chance for any money once infiltrators start being killed as soon as they're uncovered. The elements already in motion and proceeding at the same pace along routes destined to converge at some future date will come together suddenly. This year it was reported in the system's media that 1980 saw no fewer than 9 major riots in the large U.S. cities. But during 1980, I recall only one riot, Miami, reported as such by the media. Sometimes it's difficult to tell exactly how far along things actually are at any given moment because of the controlled media. Big Brother will never allow Dan Rather to report that he is hanging on the ropes of his eyelids. Look at the situation in Britain. When that occurs on a comparative scale here, it will mean the end of the system. Media reports indicate only weeks ago that a dam was blown up in New Jersey, already a critical shape for usable water, and resulted in the system's puppet in charge declaring a state of emergency. The balance the system maintains today is incredibly delicate and highly vulnerable to attack by just individuals. It isn't a case of kill or be killed. Instead, it's a matter of killing in preference to allowing death to win by default. I believe that though past experience, by weighing in cause and effect, by taking these incidents that have occurred over approximately the last year, we can estimate closely the timetable for the destruction of the system. The weakening of society, the increase of the number of those fighting for their life who step outside master's rules, what the blacks can be expected to do, almost universal apathy, all the way to hostility towards the system among the masses and so on, will increase until the current balance becomes absolutely untenable, and when all bets will be canceled, the gloves will come off and helter-skelter will commence. Those already dead in the Jews' money, and especially those now exercising power through the Jews' money, will fall like flies when first the system can no longer maintain artificially, as it does now, the hellish, unnatural life support of the megalopoly that contains the bulk of the genetic morass and clonish, zombie-like lost whites, and second, with the money weapon having evaporated into thin air from their hands. The sold-out politicians and pigs become fair game for a population bent on blood gut. Those who own the show today will go to their reward wondering why and how this could happen to them, how the tables could have turned so fast. The beginning is here, and few recognize it. The end will even be more unexpected. And that's the end of the reading from Siege, and I hope you let it sink in. And that's it for today. We'll be back tomorrow on Tuesday with Stray Dog. I've been gone and he's been gone. We're finally back together. So 14-5. Thank you. This is Terrible Tommy, Tom Metzger.
Schemes and say it isn't what it means, but let me tell you what it means. This means war.
Insurgent Radio Network calling. This is Insurgent Radio Network, and this is Terrible Tommy, Tom Metzger, here in the heartland, in the bunker, right here in north central Indiana, transmitting to the world.
Terrible Tommy.